So Dr. Richard Allen, he'll talk this morning. He's a professor at University of Idaho, and he leads the Water Resources Research Program at the Kimberly Research and Extension Center at UI, and work mostly at evapotranspiration. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have a pointer if you need.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the first two speakers laying a lot of the groundwork. I'm going to shift gears a little bit in a couple ways. One, talk about evapotranspiration retrievals from satellite, and then secondly, talk more about satellite rather than UAVs. And it's a nice spectrum, UAV to satellites. It's a big part of our future ways to do the integration. But primarily, and because of the title of this symposium, it includes decision making, I want to dwell a little bit on just some of the applications, some of the motivation for developing the production of ET maps from satellite, and then also what motivates us as far as accuracy endeavors. I'd like to recognize my co-speaker, Aisha Klitsch. She'll be talking next about the eFlux, Google eFlux application. So you guys don't need to be told this, but especially in irrigated parts of the country, water is under a lot of tension. So evapotranspiration estimates are very important to monitor consumption of water, especially where there are conflicts, and that's going to get more and more. So there's just a list of all the people who are very interested in getting high accuracy evapotranspiration maps, especially at the field scale, which we get from Landsat. Just maybe more specifics on the types of applications. The ones that are bolded here are the applications where accuracy really does matter. If we're trying to assess aquifer depletion and sustainability, we probably ought to get the consumption correct. And spatially. And then when we get into some of the litigation, the legal things, attorneys like to argue about microns of ET. It's ridiculous, but it's real. And, when you tell them, plus or minus 20-30%, they tend to come unglued. We need accuracies, consistent accuracies, probably within 10%, plus or minus, for assessing depletion of the water resource, so looking at a growing season. Well, this is what we endeavor to produce. This is a map of evapotranspiration from southeast Idaho, showing the Snake Plain aquifer region, that big flat area, and then it's pretty obvious to see what irrigation does in a dry climate like Idaho. And then the benefit of Landsat, and I'll just zoom in here, the huge benefit of Landsat with 30-meter resolution is we can see individual fields, and water rights are generally tied to individual fields just because each field might be supplied by a groundwater pump, or just the nature of a surface water right may be tied to a field. So it's at the field level that water rights are argued. It's at the field scale, like Ray and Jerry talked about, management is done. And so one of the high benefits of Landsat is the 30-meter resolution. The metric model, NDFlux, which is its derivative on the Google Earth Engine, uses a surface energy balance, so it really highly leverages the thermal band of Landsat. The reason we do this is that it gives us an idea of actual ET. And we really key off from over on the left the basic truth that evaporation requires energy. If I want to evaporate this bottle of water, what do I have to do? I've got to add a lot of energy to it. It's no different from a plant. The plant is going to convert liquid to vapor. It has to have energy. And it takes that from the environment, from photons from the sun, photons from the atmosphere. And so satellites cannot see vapor, but with Landsat we can see thermal. So those three components of the energy balance on the right are generally thermally driven, so we can do our best effort at estimating those and then calculate ET as a residual. And here's why we use energy balance rather than just strictly a vegetation index, like Jerry and Ray talked about. If we have water shortage, that's going to reduce ET. And if it's an acute problem, we may not see that manifested in the vegetation index, but we do want to see it manifested in our transpiration estimate. And then crop differences, differences in planting dates, salinity effects all impact at least the time series of ET. Metric, we do have to have a thermal band. That's what we love about Landsat, and my last slide's going to say why we need more Landsats, just so that we have the higher revisit time that Ray talked about. We can apply models like Metric with some of the bigger daily, so-called daily satellites like MODIS, AVHRR, VIRS, but they are a very large pixel size, from anywhere from 400 to a couple kilometers in size. So we really lose our ability to discriminate individual fields. So we can use those satellites, but we tend not to. And ground-based, of course, sensible heat flux is a convective process, so we do need an estimate of wind speed. We do that using some kind of blending layer. And then reference ET is really a major horse that we ride with this. We use reference ET, especially in between satellite overpass days, to know what the weather impacts are on the total evapotranspiration. So we get a relative reference ET from the snapshot of the satellite, and then we use ground-based reference ET to apply that daily. Here's just a quick look at some of the data inputs. Again, weather for reference ET. But the primary input is the thermal band, surface temperature is derived from that, and then the energy balance. Talk just the fact that high resolution is really critical for individual fields. To calibrate Metric, I'm not going to get into the components. Those are published if you're curious about it. One of the things we do in Metric to offset some of the biases that we have in our estimates of net radiation, soil heat flux, sensible heat fluxes, we pick some of the extreme conditions in the image, the hot condition, the cold condition, and actually assign values of ET. We specify what we are confident in, and because we are specifying ET, it really doesn't matter if we have biases in some of our energy balance components, because we use that essentially just to spatially distribute that ET. So we apply what we call the cold pixel and the hot pixel. The hot pixel, if there's any residual evaporation from recent precipitation events, we'll run a simulation of that and assign that. And then for the cold pixel, we assign the alfalfa reference ET. Alfalfa does a pretty good job of reaching maximum ET that's based on energy availability. And then we just invert the energy balance that we showed earlier and solve for sensible heat flux, and then we calibrate a temperature-based method for estimating convective heat flux. Here's what we were talking about with bias correction. We know that we've got biases when we're looking down from 700 kilometers. In all that list of estimates, any one of those can cause a train wreck with accuracy of ET from remote sensing. And so with the bias correction, we're actually putting any biases in our net radiation G estimates and ET possibly into the sensible heat flux estimate, and then those tend to calculate back out of the equation when we calculate ET. So it tends to work quite well in giving us a consistent accuracy. Just a little bit of background on the calibration. If we were to plot land surface temperature on the y-axis versus NDVI, we see that cooling effect that Jerry talked about. So high NDVI is associated with cooler temperatures. We don't use that information directly, but we do use it to give us an idea of what the temperature is that's associated with that maximum ET condition, and then what temperature is probably associated with low NDVI. We can see a scattering in this particular image at low NDVI just because some fields are wet, some fields are dry. So then if we process and then we plot the relative ET, and we tend to use what we call a fraction of reference ET, just actual over reference, we can see at full cover, we tend to max out at an ETRF of about 1, which is what we would hope for. And then we can see at low NDVI, we've got quite a spectrum ranging according to the dryness, wetness of the fields. I do want to comment, Jerry correctly indicated that NDVI tends to saturate at a LAI of about 4. And if you're trying to estimate LAI, that's probably a bad thing. But I want to point out that ET also saturates at an LAI of about 3 or 4. So NDVI, if your purpose is to estimate a coefficient for evapotranspiration, LAI is a very good index to use because it tends to saturate at about the same time as ETRF, the fraction of reference ET. And you can kind of see that. In fact, here it kind of indicates from the energy balance that ET is saturating at an NDVI of about 0.7, 0.75. You see that plateau. So and SAVI, actually, you get a longer plateau. So if you're trying to find just a singular relationship, you'll have more success with NDVI than SAVI. Just want to point that out. By the way, Jerry's not here to defend himself, but Jerry's one of those rare individuals who can draw a curve between two points. And it's the right curve, usually. So, okay, so we get a snapshot of ET. What do we do with that? Because we are usually interested in ET for a longer time period if we're looking at resource consumption. So we go back to that reference, the fraction of reference ET, because that's consistent from day to day regardless of the weather. The weather can get hot and dry, cool and cloudy. But we hope that the ET of the crop rises and falls with the reference ET. So it's the relative ratio that we want to extrapolate day to day, because that's, or I should say interpolate. So each of these blue points is a Landsat image that we're fortunate to get with clear skies. And you can see a corn crop here. You can see it's fairly consistent. And then we apply reference ET daily with weather data to get a daily estimate of reference ET, and then calculate ET from that. Metric itself is what we have developed and utilized. It's finding a fair amount of usage throughout the U.S. now. We kind of call it an engineer's tool. It's not intended for wide scale application, at least in one step. Our focus is on small areas where we can do a lot of review and calibration. And its accuracy, if it's done by, you know, a person who's experienced, knows what ET looks like, knows what wet soil looks like, just knows the culture, knows physics of energy balance, they can probably consistently get within plus or minus 10% over, say, a growing season. Formula for accuracy, we can't expect totally automated processing to have as much accuracy as a trained human mind. And so you can see the word human show up twice in this formula. And as I'll point out later, our biggest enemy with satellites, as you can imagine, are clouds, especially in a cloud-prone area. And we tend in our processing to spend probably 70% of our effort on just treating clouds, mitigating for clouds because of the time gaps. The development of the ET from energy balance, we've got that down pretty well. It's automated. But then we just suffer and sweat blood trying to do something with a six-week time gap. What do you do to fill that in when you know that there's development of the crop? So we need more satellites. Metrics have been coded in different languages. It's even been applied to some UAV imagery. This is some olive data from Chile, 10 centimeter data. You can see the transpiration from the crop, the estimates, and then the very little evaporation from the soil. A lot of the applications have been out west just because that's where a lot of the water tension is with irrigated systems. This is an old map. There's a lot more applications now. Some areas like IDWR, Department of Water Resources in Idaho, has actually serves up ET data now on the web. So you can go to this website and download monthly data for a number of years that have been processed. You can outline in red an area if you're interested in a certain service area, irrigation district, and you can pull down your own water consumption data, so, or for an individual field. So it's pretty powerful. I think this is in the future for a lot of the western states anyway. Real quickly, and Aisha Klitsch, our development partner, is going to talk about efflux. So, but I just want to present a little bit on efflux, because at the end I want to compare between what you can get with a manual calibration metric and then what's on the in the future for us with automated calibration. Efflux is essentially a metric adapted to the Google Earth engine. Here's a URL for it, and Aisha will present that also. It also uses Landsat imagery for field scale estimation. Because it's automated, we've had to come up with different techniques, better techniques for calibration, including this grid. I think Aisha will talk a bit more about that. Because it's automated, we have to automate the access to the weather data, so we use some of the weather forecast data. For the U.S., we use the North American Land Data Simulation System in LDAS. GridMet is bias-corrected in LDAS using PRISM. And then for the rest of the globe, we use the climate forecast system, CFSB2. We need soils information to estimate that background evaporation associated with a bare soil condition. So we use StatsGo for the U.S. It's the better method, but then for the rest of the globe, we use the FAO soils database. And then we do like to have an idea of land use, so we use the national land cover data set for the U.S. and then a European product for the rest of the globe. And elevation maps are generally based on the shuttle mission. Sorry, my mouth is getting dry. So we use that gridded weather data, for example, to give us an idea of hourly and daily reference ET. Here's just a picture of reference ET going through the year 2012 for the United States based on the NLDAS and GridMet. And, you know, we could see that reference ET just kind of climbs in the Midwest during the drought period. Here's evaporation that we use, again, to estimate what that bare soil component is doing. And we can see rain events during 2012, and this type of information is used during the calibration of efflux, or metric even. We use it for that. So we can just see a sequence of evaporation associated with precipitation events. And Aisha will show some of these. So efflux is kind of a nice, simple application. It's just a one-sheet website, and you can just select your image to process and then look at various intermediate products. Here, for example, is a false color. It's done one Landsat scene at a time, which is about 160 kilometer on a side. Here's just an idea of what the menu looks like, some of the intermediate products, and then down at the bottom, the ET map. Albedo, total reflectance from the surface. We can see different albedos associated with different fields. NDVI that we've talked about. Surface temperature, again, one of the big advantages of Landsat, having the surface temperature map. And then this relative ET, the CTRF fraction, we get that map out. And that's what we are after with any of these applications. Just a little bit on accuracy, some blind comparisons. This one actually wasn't blind, but that same olive data using Landsat, looking at the four energy balance components compared to some eddy covariance data, fairly good estimation. Here's a truly blind study, some Bowen ratio data from Aisha's group in Nebraska for 5 overpass states showing pretty good agreement. Nevada, another blind comparison study with some USGS data, mostly Bowen ratio and eddy covariance for mostly alfalfa fields, fairly good accuracy. In Kimberley, we had the luxury of Jim Wright working his whole career with Wayne lysimeters, so we have a lot of data we can compare to there. And we don't know why this came out so close. I was looking for errors we made just to get a little bit more separation, but if you do your homework right, you can get pretty good accuracy. It won't always be that good, for sure. And then finally, a blind intercomparison. This is the Palo Verde Irrigation District in Southeast California, Blythe, in the Blythe area, if you're familiar with it. It's about 100,000 acres. It's of interest because a lot of this water will be going to the Los Angeles area to serve the cities, so they're quite interested in monitoring fallow systems. So the USGS funded a study that set up some Bowen ratio systems, did a total water balance of the district. We had a blind intercomparison of some of the leading models. I've got everything marked out here except Metric. This data hasn't been published yet. But again, Metric came in fairly close, within about 2% for individual overpass days for the fields that were measured by Bowen ratio. And then if we look at a total water balance for the 100,000 acres, which is usually what the water management entities are interested in, if we aggregate all of the Landsat pixels over that area and compare it to a water balance, we came within a couple percent again. And this was completely blind. We had no knowledge of the ground data. And two of the other models marked here also were within about 12%, which is probably adequate for water management work. We always hope for good accuracy. We hope that it's non-biased for water rights work. Let me just move on from there. One of the advantages of having a kind of manual operated method is we can do a lot more review and intervention on the images. We can customize it for different things. For example, we can put in a three-source estimation for tree canopies, where there's a large discontinuity between what's going on the soil and what's going on in the tree, can help. If you got a lot of organic mulches, like after wheat harvest, you got this insulative blanket of straw on the surface, it's probably good to account for that in the energy balance. Up in complex terrain mountains, it's good to look at the impact of solar radiation on slopes, aerodynamics as wind flows over that terrain. We try to take that into account also. So I'll just leave you with just a quick side-by-side we did with Metric versus Efluxes for an area in southern Idaho. And largely indistinguishable, so it looks like we're doing a adequate job with Eflux. I do want to say that the Eflux calibration, though automatic, came in about 10% low, so we did have to stretch that, but we do have that provision on the Eflux website to do that. So if you know what you're looking at, you can make that adjustment. If you don't know what you're looking at, you just take what you get with the automated calibration, and it may not be accurate. We're still working on that, trying to improve it. One of the things that we can do manually also on the left is we can do what we call a thermal adjustment. The thermal, for example, on Landsat 8 is 100 meter native resolution. We can sharpen that down to 30 meters using NDVI or some other indice. And when we do, we can get a lot more crisp information, which is usually useful for water rights determination. We essentially are picking up ET that is estimated outside of a field just due to the thermal bleeding, you know, the bigger pixel size, and we're just kind of pouring it back into the field. We can see impacts of roads and such. That's not in Eflux yet, but it probably will be coming. But there's a lot of enhancements that you can do if you're interested in accuracy for water rights and other purposes. And I'll leave you with this. Like I said, we spend 70-80% of our time on cloud mitigation. We wouldn't have to do that if we had a daily Landsat. And it's not so expensive. I mean, they're about $800 million a pop, but it's only 3 coffee lattes per American per year. And we all do selfies, right? Most of us. Why not do an Earth selfie at the field scale every year? So I encourage you, we encourage you to talk to your congressional people, senators, encourage them to try to fund and give mandates to NASA and USGS for more Landsats. The agricultural community really, really needs this. So, thank you.
This is a pretty detailed question, but many slides ago you showed a relationship between NDVI and the ballast for ET. Up, 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 gets one when the NDVI gets on. And in that data, there was a sharp hook right at the end, and it's a small hook, but there's a ton of data in there. I was waiting for you to tell us why that suddenly curved over.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of new data, so I haven't looked closely at it. We often do not see that. I'm just going to take a guess that maybe those are some fields that have a higher albedo. So that would cause the energy balance to estimate lower ET, and that albedo may cause the NDVI to go up. You know, it could be just more NIR reflected, which would raise the albedo.
In other data sets, you don't see that?
Usually not. Yeah, usually not. And those could be stress fields, but you wouldn't think they'd be only associated with the very highest NDVI. So it's probably a physiological phenomenon, different crop type or something. You know, we often see potatoes. Russet Burbank potatoes are one of the few crops that generally don't max up to that 1.0 for an alfalfa reference. We often see them at around 0.9. I don't know that their NDVI would be that much higher, but it could be just potato crops, something. Yeah?
You made a reference to remote sensitive water vapor. Are you looking at the Cirrus band for Landsat 8? Because it's sort of like both ice and water vapor and liquid.
Yeah, do we look at the Cirrus band of Landsat 8? We do, and it scares us to death when we look at it, because you see this beautiful image and you're really excited to process it, and then you open the Cirrus band and you see Cirrus jet contrails and stuff that were invisible, and it kind of shakes your confidence in that image. I mean, it's a good thing to do, but we process anyway, because you know the question is, does that impact thermal enough? We can use that, and we can use it for cloud masking. But it probably doesn't tell us enough about the atmospheric profile of water vapor to be useful to, you know, estimate a flux of vapor. It's useful to characterize clouds.
You were speaking about the field scale of the satellite, and we were wondering yesterday, do you think it's possible to have a plot scale?
Is it possible to have a plot scale with satellite? With satellite.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's someplace in the future. You know, it takes about 10 years to plan, design, and launch satellites, and probably takes 10 years before that to get enough support for satellites, because they're expensive. They're getting cheaper with small sats. And I think with some of the small sats, we'll begin seeing plot scale. You know, we currently have 1 meter, 2 meter data with some of the small sats, commercial sats. Unfortunately, small sats have a hard time collecting thermal information, because you need a pretty large telescope, because you don't have as many photons in that region. So you need bigger optics. And that's always going to be expensive. And field scale, I used to show a formula. The smaller the pixel, something has to give. Either you have a more narrow swath, you know, maybe only 20 kilometers instead of 160. And what that means then is you have a much longer revisit time. So you give up things. And Landsat is really an ideal compromise between revisit time, 16 days with one, 8 days with two. And a small enough pixel, you can differentiate individual fields if they're large enough. But not so small that we then give up on our swath width. And of course, electronics, the future satellites will have longer, wider arrays, so we'll get better coverage. But I'm not sure what you mean by plot scale, but it'll be I think the next Landsat after 9, which will launch in about 2020, Landsat 10 may very well be 10 meter instead of 30 meter. The thermal instead of 100 might be 60, back to 60. But it'll probably be at least 2030, 2040 before we ever see 10 meter thermal. I think that's a long time coming. So that'll have to come from aerial or UAV. Yes, if there's time. Yeah.
You're talking about some spatial resolution. Have you ever worked with the Sentinel to do that?
Yeah, the question is, do we work with Sentinel too? We do. You know, it breaks our hearts because the Europeans did not put thermal with Sentinel 2, so we do not have the thermal data. And they recognize that now, and they feel badly about it. They realize but it's a little late, yeah. There's two Sentinel 2s flying now. They're beautiful satellites, beautiful for shortwave. But what we've been doing lately is we use the NOAA VIR satellite, which has 375-meter thermal. And it's technically a daily satellite, although it's usually every 3-4 days before you get a near nadir where you'd want to use the thermal data. But we couple that with the Sentinel 2, and we use the Sentinel 2 to sharpen the VIRs down to a field scale, just assuming that cooler temperatures are associated with NDVI. And then we process it with the metric energy balance. And you can still see the VIRs blocks and such. It's not as good, but it does fill in those gaps between the Landsat, you know, if we have clouds. So we'll probably be using that more and more. And the Europeans are talking about perhaps launching some thermal, strictly thermal satellites, free flyers, they call them, you know, cost maybe $100, $150 million to complement the Sentinel. So they're a little behind in the game, but they're seriously considering it. Yeah, good question.
Thank you. One more.
Just an operating question out of that. When I drive through southern Idaho in the middle of the summer and the winter wheat is ripening, I wonder if the farmers know when they can stop watering it. I mean, if you just look at that specific issue of operating efficiency with irrigation, is there something that, what do you see that remote sensing can offer?
Yeah, good question. Why do farmers irrigate Senesse wheat? We've been telling them for years that they don't have to do that. Now, some of them argue that, well, I'm not irrigating for the crop. I'm irrigating so I can get my disc to penetrate the ground after the harvest. You know, there's other agronomic reasons. Or they're recharging moisture for the next year. They don't think we'll get enough over winter. But that, you know, you point out a really important application of the satellite-based ET, Paul, is that's to actually show the reduction in ET as the crop senesces. You know, farmers just say, well, that grain's filling, just one more dosage. Now, hopefully, if the soil's dry, which it usually is with grain, that water isn't totally wasted. It'll hopefully stay there for the next year's crop. Some of the time.
You could tell them.
Yeah, we have been. They don't listen, but we have been.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.